Hi, I'm Michelle Sawatsky-Coop. Thanks for finding your way to our Heroes in Our Midst podcast, brought to you by Elite Sports Injury. With five locations in Winnipeg, they are here when we need physiotherapy or massage therapy. Your body's worth it. Make the time for yourself. Today's guest is someone who has made time for many, including myself. When I was a member of the Canadian National Women's Volleyball Team, Dr. Neil Creighton made time for us all. His knowledge, his incredible care, his experience, and that connection is something I'm so thankful for. And now, being able to connect with him as one of our heroes seemed like a perfect fit. He is all about the human behind the performance. He has taken care of so many, and above all, has been concerned with their wellness in order to make performance possible. Dr. Creighton is one of the longest-standing sport medicine doctors in Manitoba. He has worked with the Bombers and the Jets for years, in addition to multiple Olympic and Paralympic athletes. He's a published author, he volunteers at a homeless shelter, and he is grounded in a faith that continues to motivate him in his service to others. Knowing all of that, I was really excited for us to get to know Dr. Neil Creighton from the inside out. And he was willing to share the story of his journey from the very beginning.
Yeah, the first job I wanted to do was be a professional basketball player. I got very excited about basketball and football when I was in high school and was fortunate enough to be the captain of our football and basketball teams. Played university basketball for about a month and failed all my Christmas exams because I wasn't doing very much work. So if you're trying to inspire people who may not do so well in their first academic work, there's certainly hope after failing every single exam at Christmas. And so basketball was put on the back burner at that point, and I started to focus more on academics. But sport has always been part of my DNA. I think people have that in them or they don't. Obviously, you know about that. I love to use my body. I love to have a competition. I think I have a little bit of ADHD and need to be busy. Mm-hmm. And so when I have spare time, it's used physically as much as I can. When I was young and single and trying to stay out of the bars, I trained for the Ironman for several years, and it was a good use of time. I've passed that on to my eldest child, who's training for a marathon in Vancouver as we speak. But yeah, these are things that are part of your DNA. And I would say that athleticism has always been part of who I am.
You know, I don't think I did not expect, you surprised me with that very first story of yours. And I think coming from a doctor, I mean, you know, so you bounced back. Did you then not play basketball anymore and decide to focus on your studies? Or how quickly did you bounce back from something like that?
Well, I just played junior varsity after that and studied very hard and was able to get, I think, a 3.85 in my first year after pulling things up. But it was clearly a lesson that the habits of high school were not going to be adequate in the university context. And so I learned that lesson and learned how to study and learned how to discipline myself. But it was a wake-up call. And it was a very blue time when you think, gracious, like, what's my life going to be? I'm not even going to get a science degree here. So yeah, a very, I think, an important little pruning activity where I felt the supernatural was kind of taking some things away that maybe were not things that should be my focus.
Wow, that's so cool. And I know for sure, I don't think you would talk to one first year college or university student athlete that hasn't gone through some kind of transition and some kind of moment, not that extreme in a lot of cases, but where they go, oh, this is what it is. This is a lot. And then boom, they, like you said, you got to pull it up or it's not going to happen. So you wanted to get a science degree, that you already said. Was that your bend? Did you already know you were kind of leaning towards trying to find a way to make sport part of your career?
No, it really wasn't. I had a basketball coach in high school that I greatly respected. He was a significant mentor to me. And I told him I was going to be going into science because I was good in the sciences in high school. And he said, Neil, if you go into science, you're going to be selling shoes in 3 years. You should go into engineering. There's a lot of jobs for engineers. And I said, well, there's nothing wrong with selling shoes. And maybe I should be an engineer. So I signed up for engineering. So the first day of engineering in my first year of university, I was away from my girlfriend at the time. And I really felt lonely. And it was basically as much as that. I said, I'm not going to be in engineering. I'm going to go into science. So I went into science. So the dream of being a physician was nowhere even close. But then once I started getting the knack of studying and learned how to do well in university, people started saying, hey, well, are you going to apply to medicine? And I had really never thought of it, to be frank. I was kind of a party kid and, you know, I think narcissistic and not really concerned with that part of life. And so it seemed that this, I was being guided into this profession, wrote the kind of the MCAT and did well on that. And, you know, another group of friends said, you should go into law. So I wrote the LSAT and started looking at going into law. I was accepted to law school actually in my third year and then just kind of persevered and got accepted into medicine. So it really was not a lifetime goal by any means.
Was it in your studies of medicine that you sort of turned the self-focus and kind of figured it might be pretty cool to do things for others in this life of mine?
Well, I'm going to give the thanks to this to my wife. It was in that third year of science that I met a beautiful young woman who's now my wife. And she came from a Christian home, and I was a person who didn't have any faith in my life. And through a series of events and a bunch of little old ladies kind of praying for me, and I tell this story in my book about kind of coming to know Jesus and that having a profound change in who I was. And it was in my first year of medical school that it happened. So it seemed that, okay, this kind of narcissistic, self-focused, self-absorbed person needed to change a little bit and in fact needed to change a lot. And it took many, many decades actually, and that change is continuing. But the teachings of compassion and service to others really began to resonate for me there in medical school as a newfound person of faith.
Yeah. When I read some on your website, I love how you put it. You talked about the privilege and the opportunity to serve others. And I think you're right. I mean, those who do have, you know, a faith and believe, like even when Jesus was here on earth, he did serve others. That was his purpose in coming. And that's the whole story. And I like what you say to your patients. You say that you're their waiter and you serve them. That's fantastic.
Yeah. And it's, I use it virtually every day in the clinic. And I think it characterizes the relationship almost perfectly. That I'm here to serve you. You have a need, you have a desire to get well or to have some type of improvement in your health status. And whatever is going to work for you is what we're going to do. And the menu idea very much fits with musculoskeletal or sport medicine, right? Mm-hmm. You know, some people don't ever come near me with an injection, doctor. That stuff's terrible. And some people, doc, give me that injection right now. And everybody's different. Doc, I would never have surgery for this. You know, doc, sign me up tomorrow. And so that's the waiter function. Explain to the patient the pros and cons of each specific intervention in relationship to their difficulty and help them make the best decision for them. So the waiter concept, I think, fits perfectly.
Yeah. So you spent years learning to be this server, as we're talking about, and talk a little bit about your journey through learning sport medicine. So you got into medicine, you qualified for the field. Was it right away sport? You don't specialize right away. How did that decision come to be?
No. So I had a strong desire to work in emergency. And so I worked in emergency for the first 6 years of my career at the Grace Hospital and then at the Health Sciences Center. And I found that work really rewarding. And when I was at the Health Sciences Center, I began teaching the interns about what were called orthopedic emergencies. And I really loved the orthopedic work, but I had been a fainter during medical school and I fainted almost every time I went in the operating theater. And so I knew I couldn't be a surgeon. So I kind of liked orthopedics, but I couldn't be a surgeon. So is there any place for me? And that's when I found sport medicine. And then I did a little digging and found that there was a sport medicine fellowship at the University of British Columbia, where you got a master's degree in human kinetics and then learned how to be a sport med doc. And my father had been born in Vancouver. There was always a pull to Vancouver. And so went out there for a couple of years and got my sport medicine fellowship and then came back to Winnipeg in the early 90s and started a clinic in Hargrave, where I first met you.
So now, why did you start a clinic? Why didn't you just work at one?
Well, I did. I, when I first came back to Winnipeg, I worked at the Pan Am Clinic kind of half-time. I had a friend His name was Mitch Cosman, and he owned a clinic here in Winnipeg. He had lived next door to my mother, another one of these serendipity things. Mitch and I had become friends, and he kind of wanted me to work with him. But the Pan Am Clinic was kind of the big clinic, and so I kind of wanted to work there. And so through a series of events, I just kind of worked at both at the beginning of the clinic. And then I became good friends with a guy by the name of Mike McKay, who was a doc at the Pan Am Clinic. And we kind of wanted to start our own place. And that was the beginnings of Legacy, 25 years ago.
Yeah, amazing. And still going strong today, isn't it?
Yeah, we're actually opening a satellite location, a second clinic in Winnipeg.
Cool. That's very exciting. So I'm curious about when I've been injured or people that I've played with or players that I've coached as a coach. Now, this is a big thing for me. When we send kids who are injured, let's say, or a kid on your team gets injured and where should I go? We're going to send them somewhere. Sometimes you go to the emergency. I mean, just because it's sheer, like this is an emergency, the foot's not in place or it's whatever. I think a lot of us think there's such a difference between just bringing an injury to a doctor or bringing an injury to a sports medicine doctor. And I'll be honest, on real terms, I might think I want to go to a sport medicine doctor because he's going to get it that I don't just want to get better. I want to get better quick so that I can play. Is there a difference there? And how do you view that as a sports medicine doctor?
Yeah, I think the two things you're kind of digging at, I think number one would just be a sense of understanding the importance of sport in a person's life.
Yes.
My doctor was an internist when I grew up. He lived on our street. And I would go to him with my sport injuries and he would say, Neil, why don't you just quit football? That's stupid. You're hurting yourself. Didn't seem to understand what was in my heart. I remember breaking my wrist and he said, Neil, I'm not even going to refer you to a surgeon if you're going to keep playing football. I want to play football. You know, it was a part of my world. So I think sport medicine doctors get that. And then the rest of it is just competence. So I'm not at all competent at delivering babies or doing other things that family doctors do. It's just my area of competence happens to be, sport and exercise medicine. So my training and my experience is seeing people who have musculoskeletal problems often in the context of a sporting injury. That's what I do. Again, your family doctor is much better at other things, managing your cholesterol levels and looking after your blood pressure and your diabetes and those family doc things. I have a lot of respect for family physicians and, all medical people in the community. Sport and exercise medicine has become a very big domain of knowledge. And I have a saying that we treat babas and beefcakes, that the principles of sport medicine, it's not about a patient. It's about a type of practice. It's biomechanical in nature. It emphasizes a good clinical assessment involving physical examination. And it almost always involves the prescription of specific exercises to increase and maintain one's function. Mm-hmm. And you could make an argument that that's more important for little old ladies than it is for the 15-year-old guy who has a sore shoulder throwing baseballs.
Amazing how that encompasses all of us. And I suppose, having been through elite sport and then living real life, being able to function in real life becomes decades longer of a goal than to actually, like you say, throw a baseball or hit a volleyball or those kind of things. So then when you're thinking of sport medicine, to me, when you say understanding the importance of sport to your patient or to the person coming in, that really gets us onto the inside of things, not just the outside of things. So, I mean, my next question for you, I think would be, I'm curious about your time working with athletes. I'm sure you have a million stories to share on insight on us as humans. It goes so much farther, doesn't it, in your treatment when you work with athletes. Let's go to that specifically. It goes beyond the physical, doesn't it?
Yes. So with virtually every patient, we have what's called a biopsychosocial approach. So you come to me because of a biomedical problem. You have a sore shoulder. Mm-hmm. And there's a biomedical reason for that. Say your rotator cuff is becoming a problem. The psychosocial fits into that. You get all of your joy in life through playing volleyball with your friends. That's been cut off. Now you're staying at home. You're putting on weight. You're feeling sad. You're not sleeping. And pretty soon we have a significant life crisis. Well, that started from your shoulder problem. And so figuring out the biopsychosocial is important for all people, including athletes. Athletes have a higher preponderance of mental illness than do the regular population. And it kind of makes sense if you're very performance focused and your performance isn't good, you become self-critical. And then you're having coaches yelling at you. And some back in the national team days, you remember, one of my main jobs was to deal with some of the psychosocial fallout from coaches. And so, yeah, everybody has a biopsychosocial story to tell. And that's the way medicine is practiced now. And understanding athletes, hey, this isn't just an ankle to you that you've injured. It's that you've lost a big part of your world. Mm-hmm. There's a fascinating statistic, and it's this. A person who tears their anterior cruciate ligament has the same cognitive decline as a person with a concussion. How do you figure that out?
Wow.
Well, it's interesting. Well, so the person's not exercising. They're in pain. They're removed from their normal stimulus. They're not playing sport. They're not going to school. Oh, that leads to cognitive difficulties. And so we do some of these cognitive tests on kids who've torn their ACL. Wow, it looks just like they have had a concussion. So that helps tie together this idea that you're more than your injury. It's the injury and its effect on you. And then also, we often put too much focus on sport. That, you know, when I used to train for the Ironman, people would say, Neil, what are you running from? You know, what's in you? Why do you have to do this all the time? Why are you so obsessed with this? And it was an obsession for me. And becoming aware of what drives that in people is important. You know, you want to take the tools you have and use them for the best outcomes. But very quickly, sport can become a difficulty. And then again, I think sport medicine doctors understand that very well. Okay, is this all just good for this person? Let's get them back to activity. We have to be cautious for becoming codependent. I just got to get Michelle back to sport as fast as possible. Maybe not. Maybe there's some other issues in the way that we need to deal with first.
Wow, that becomes huge. And you just touched on, I think a big part of this too is the pressures that you feel as the physician, sort of making some of these decisions and helping these athletes. And what's the dynamic of coaches to sport medicine?
Well, I've been with the Blue Bombers now for about 28 years. And my first coach was Cal Murphy. And it was my first job working in with the Bombers. I'd been with the Jets for a couple of years. And so understood coaches at that time. But Cal, bless his heart, was a very, very strong leader. And when he saw me, a very young, kind of naive doctor, you know, doc, that guy's fit to play tomorrow, isn't he? And you're thinking, no, he's not, but not really knowing what to do in that context.
Right.
I would say that over the last 25 years, for example, being with the Bombers, the coaches are incredibly respectful. They get it, particularly with the help that concussion has been with us, understanding the importance of listening to medical rules and medical protocols and treating the health of athletes as a much more important criteria now than they did 25 years ago. So my experience with coaches has been fabulous. You just have to speak frankly with them. And I have some pet peeves, but they're kind of small compared to how much I respect the coaches, have a good relationship with them. You know, working with Mike O'Shea now with the Bombers, he's an incredible guy, very easy to get along with, deals with us as the medical professionals very, very well. And he knows that we just have the best interests of everybody at heart. Lots of experience calling balls and strikes. That's really what we do. We call balls and strikes from a medical perspective.
Yeah. Wow. So have you ever had to put an athlete out on the field or on the ice or wherever, and you just knew, like you watched them go out there and you kind of cringed and went, I don't know how this is going to go?
Many times.
Many times.
Many times. Yeah. And it's not so much me putting them out on the ice or putting them out on the field, but it's having a frank discussion with the athlete. Listen, you have an impairment here, not a concussion related impairment. That's kind of an absolute. But for example, a knee related impairment. Hey, brother, your knee's swollen. Your knee's unstable. I don't think you should go. Doc, you know, this is very important to me. And then trying to go through the risks and benefits quickly with the athlete and trying to make that decision and being kind of terrified when they go back on. Where there's not an absolute contraindication to them not playing, but you would still be much more comfortable with them sitting on the bench. So those have happened many, many times. And I don't think I can report any really terrible consequences as a result of that, thankfully. But yeah, you're nervous a lot of the time. When you're covering a football game and you're watching what's happening there, it's like, oh my goodness, this is violent. Why are they doing that to each other? So you really are kind of on the edge of your seat.
For sure. Now that makes me think of, do you treat from sport to sport differently? Are there different injuries? I mean, if you tear an ACL, whether you do it in gymnastics or in football or in hockey, I guess you've torn an ACL.
For sure. So ACLs would be an example that would happen in many, many different sports. And the prevalence of certain injuries are obviously different in sport, right? So there's more concussions in football than there are in volleyball. There's more rotator cuff injuries in volleyball than there are in football. And so you get a sense of the typical constellation of injuries in each discipline. And so you become comfortable with that, what that looks like, and what you expect. And so your expertise, like dealing with unstable shoulder in women who are 6'3" with, you know, multidirectional laxity of all their ligaments and who are hitting 1,000 balls a day, you get experience with, and you work with the national team with that. And you kind of get a sense of where they are. You know, dealing with football players who've just dislocated their finger, who most of us would be crying and going to the emergency room, doc, just put it back in. I'm going back out there. You know, you don't see that a lot in other athletes. So it is very athlete specific. The gymnasts, for example, man, do they put up with a lot of pain and difficulty. So, you know, and then triathletes, the volume that they put in of training, really quite outstanding. So absolutely, the injuries differ based on the sport, and you need to have some expertise when you're dealing with athletes from a certain discipline.
And so then as in the sport medicine role with these teams, do you collaborate with the trainers, let's say, and say, you know what, I'm seeing a lot of this injury happening right now. I think we need to strengthen this or this. Does that happen?
Yeah, so I can give you two good examples of that. So the first would be with Al Couture, who's the trainer of the Winnipeg Blue Bombers, kind of the head athletic therapist there. And Al is gold. I would say the best athletic therapist in the CFL, a great leader of the medical team with the Bombers, been around for 20 years and garners incredible respect. And so he leads our team. We work well together, tremendous interdependence. You know, that therapist, communication's wide open and you're standing with him on the sidelines talking about things. The previous discussion we had about having an athlete on the field who's got an impairment, you're talking to Al, hey, is he limping? How's he look on that play? Like, watch him, that kind of stuff. And then the National Sports Center that runs out of the University of Manitoba, when the national women's team was there, we would have IST meetings, so the integrated support team meetings with, Adrian, who was there representing sports psychology, and then they had exercise physiologists, the coaches, the strength trainers, all meeting together and collaborating for athlete health as best we could. And so in those circumstances, it's fabulous to have the interdisciplinary dialogue and get the wisdom of each person around the table. So yeah, that's the optimal nature. Now, when you're dealing with high school sport, things like that, you know, those things don't really exist most of the time. You know, it's a mom and pop or coaching and that kind of thing. So when you have a privilege of working with all those disciplines, it's really, really quite cool.
Yeah, that sounds super cool. And so different than even back in the late 80s, early 90s. I mean, it was pretty disjointed. I think it was coming together even at the highest level. I think we would remember that. Are you thrilled with how things have gone? I mean, you've been doing this now through the decades. Are you thrilled with how change is happening? Do you wish more of that could have happened or it were, should be happening? What do you think? Where are we at in your eyes? With not just athletes, but in sport medicine in general and in helping people be well.
So I think that the example of concussion has helped us a lot in drive medical change. So when I first practiced, we were returning people to sport in the same game after a concussion. That was accepted practice. In 2001, that changed. And since then, we have not done that practice. So that helped us as a sport medicine community communicate to the culture at large about some of the risks of things that are going on in sport. And so now at the CFL level, we have multiple Zoom meetings per year and then an annual meeting where we all get together and talk about athlete health. And we get input from the coaches, from the trainers, from the team owners, as a matter of fact. And, you know, instituting things like no contact practices so that athletes don't have to get hit and hit and hit all week. We saw so many injuries with that type of thing going on. That was stopped as a result of the medical committees, for example. So I think a lot of things are getting better. From that perspective, I think that, again, the impairment associated with concussion is being better treated at a national and international level. That's important. There are still some tough injuries that occur. We talked about ACL. When you tear your ACL, that's a life-altering event that, even with today's best surgeries, still leads to some impairment later in life. And so I think that helping people understand the best nature of sport, kind of moderate physical exercise. One of the things I'm learning as I age is that, you know, necessarily more isn't better. That the best you can do for people's health is moderate, regular exercise. When you become kind of an extreme exerciser, there are lots of negative consequences as a result. So when you're training for a marathon or for an Ironman, you're putting your heart at significant risk of cardiac dysrhythmias, of fibrotic changes. Can you imagine, you know, your heart beating 190 times for 12 hours as you do the Ironman per minute, for example? That's a lot of load. So trying to help the whole population become moderately fit is a goal, I think, of all sport medicine practitioners. And one of my real current passions is strength training for all people. And especially little old ladies, getting them strong so they maintain functional independence. They don't lose their balance as easily. They can get out of a chair simply by doing wall squats. My dear mom died at 92, riddled with arthritis. I had her doing 1,000 wall squats a day to maintain her functional capability. And it was effective. She swam until she was 87.
You know, I love hearing this because it's good for all of us. And I think so often we think, well, if I'm not going super hard and sweating, what am I accomplishing? And that is not what you're saying is actually the most beneficial. And so I think a lot of people stay away from physical activity because that's what they envision they're supposed to be doing.
Right. The evidence is quite clear. There's a U-shaped curve of exercise and morbidity. The people who have the least amount of fitness have the highest medical risk. The people who have the lowest amount of risk have moderate fitness, but extreme fitness up here, risks start to mount. If you're running 40 miles a week, there's a 95% chance you're injured, right? When I see people training for marathon season, almost everybody's getting injured, right? And that tells us something. And then the cardiac consequences, moderate exercise gives the best cardiac outcome, not extreme exercise. So I'm kind of an extreme exerciser in recovery. I've had heart issues related to my prior experience as a triathlete. So I've learned this the hard way. And when you start delving into that literature, oh my goodness, this is fact. This is not just some supposition. And so helping people understand, yeah, you don't have to go hard to get well.
Wow. So you're saying I need to admit that I'm over 50.
You don't look over 50.
Well, thank you. But this is great for me, honestly. I mean, and I know we're doing this to share this, but so often I'm inspired and I'm educated in these conversations. Thank you for that. You know, and I'm going to be keeping that in mind as I move forward to my workout later today. But just your conversation about that and talking about what we hope to see and what you're working towards now, it makes me think again of the time that you've spent in this field. And the question that came to mind was, is there an injury that now is fixable, but when you started, it was a way bigger deal? Do you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. That's a sobering question. Mm. And I'm not sure if there's a yes answer to that.
Right.
It's actually interesting. In many ways, the literature is going the other way. Like something called partial arthroscopic meniscectomy. So when people tear their cartilage in their knee joint, and they get it scoped. 15 years ago, every single person who had that injury had their knee scoped. And the current data would say that if there's even any wear and tear in that knee, you leave that meniscus alone. You don't operate on it. So we've actually moved away from some of those things. I don't know that there's a positive answer to that question. And it, again, one of the things that I was taught by a friend was that sometimes medicine causes problems. 30 years ago, we managed back pain with 6 weeks of bed rest, Tylenol number 3, and don't go to work. And that's what the accepted management was. And now it's get as active as soon as you can, perform strength exercises, and don't take any opioids at all. We did the same thing with concussion. The appropriate treatment is rest. Go in a dark room. Don't talk to anybody till you feel completely asymptomatic. And a colleague and I wrote a paper on this saying, you know, is rest the best medicine for concussion? And I think that paper has been and proven to be true that no, you harm people by putting them in a dark room and taking them away from all their friends and their things that give them positive emotional stimulation. And you can now successfully load people with concussion early. They start exercise 1 or 2 days after their injury. So there's been a big change. I can't tell you the prognosis is that different, unfortunately. I'm going to get back to you with that and really think of an injury that is treated better now than it was.
Yeah.
One of the true miracles, I think, is joint replacement surgery. Okay. And the technology surrounding joint replacement surgery has given so many of my patients a remarkable change in their ability to do activities and their long-term prognosis.
Yeah. Okay. I'd like to talk a little more about the inside work that you do on us as human beings when you're in your line of work and you're dealing with us, whether it's athletes or not. To focus on the athlete side first, you've worked in amateur sport and you've worked in professional sport. Is there more or less pressure? Have you had more positives, negatives in either of those? And is there a difference?
There's a dramatic difference. Yeah. Amateur sport is one of the most wonderful places to work that I could imagine. My experience with the national women's volleyball team was really, really wonderful. Had a tremendous amount of enjoyment with that group. I've worked for the Bombers for a long, long time. And during that time, there have been some tough things for the organization as a whole. There's been some controversy surrounding some of their upper management, some of the board of directors, some coaches. Some pretty negative things happened. And those gave the kind of a black eye to the community there. When you see people dealt with like a widget, this widget's wearing out, we need to get rid of it. That unfortunately is a thing you see in professional sport. I don't think we can deny that that happens. And I'm a relational person. And so I have this athlete on the other side of the table for me, and Now they're like my sons. And so I feel these guys are like my sons, and you're empathetic with them, but you kind of know as soon as this guy's rehabbed from his knee injury, he's being cut. That everybody's made that decision. And so that's a sad thing. And so obviously you don't really see that when you're dealing with high school basketball or other sporting events. So professional sport brings that part into it, which is relationally very, very hard. And this is why I think that the mental health of athletes has more difficulties than people who are non-athletes, particularly professional athletes. Mm-hmm. They know if they don't perform, there's another kid who's just anxious to take their spot. And most of us don't feel that kind of pressure on a day-to-day basis. If I drop 2 passes in a game, I'm getting cut. That doesn't happen to me in my clinic, right?
Right. Do you have a story or a memory of being on the side of, on the receiving side of a player who was with the team, got cut or traded because of an injury, and then came to you and said, listen, doc, I already had a bad experience over there. They let me go. My body has to work now.
Yes, I've seen many, many, many experiences just like that. I don't need to be careful about names, especially right. The professional athletes, people who had maybe the wrong diagnosis, that their problem was, for example, attributed to a concussion, when it was in fact should have been attributed to a neck injury. That person came to us and we said, well, this was not a concussion. These injuries were neck injuries. We have very good evidence of that. And the athlete's been very successful with us and had no concussions. And so things like that happen all the time. I just want to say that the medical staff amongst the CFL teams, these are all very, very good doctors. I have a lot of respect for them. And they're very dedicated to their craft and very good at their craft. And often these decisions are made in the business context as opposed to the sport medicine context, for example. So I don't want to seem negative at all to my colleagues. It's exactly the opposite. Mm-hmm. But in the business side of things, so we failed an athlete here. This athlete had one of the worst knees I've ever seen. Bone on bone arthritis, could barely walk, knees swollen, doesn't move, x-rays terrible. And so we said he does not pass his physical. He'll never get through the season. Well, guess who was the CFL sack leader for another team that year? This athlete was the CFL sack leader. And the team trainer, and who became, his actual name, Ross Hodgkinson is his name, a fascinating fellow. We kept coming, hey, doc, did you see how many sacks so-and-so had this week? So, I mean, I've made those mistakes myself where, you know, that guy's knee is never going to make it through a season, and they go and they have a fabulous year.
Yeah. What do you wish you knew? Something you know now. Is there something you wish that you knew when you started that you know now about what you do?
I think it would be less anxious. I think anxiety is something that creeps into all of our lives. And it's something that just robs us of a great amount of joy. I think it goes all the way back to medical school, very anxious in medical school. And then anxious when I started practicing emergency, like, oh my goodness, what's going to come through the door? Feeling inadequately prepared for what was there. And in fact, I was inadequately prepared for what I was going to face. Some things you just can't anticipate. But as I get older, thinking about, you know what, all the anxiety I felt all those years, most things work out the way you think they're going to work out. And don't deal with all these situations with anxiety. Trust what you've been taught. Trust your intuition. Trust the interaction with the patient. Do what you have to do. Be thorough. Take a good history, do a good physical examination, old school stuff, right? So be less anxious.
Yeah, that's great advice and great to look back. And you know, for those listening who are following in your footsteps, you know, to know that, okay, I'm going to take this one case at a time, one day at a time, one conversation at a time, and do all I can. Maybe I thought of this because your clinic is called Legacy Sport Medicine, but what do you hope your legacy is? You seem like you'll be able to do this for a very long time. I don't know how long you're planning on doing what you're doing, especially in all the places you're doing it. But when you are, you know, done and you decide to put your feet up a little bit, what do you hope you see that follows you?
Well, I think we need to be careful with that. I think legacy harkens to pride. And I think pride is one of the things that I don't want to have in my life. That does creep in, and you try to say, no, that does not give anybody glory. And so trying to stay away from pride. And so a friend of mine once really rebuked me in this when he said, as I was talking about legacy, Neil, that does sound so proud. Okay. And I think it was probably good counsel. Yeah. However, having said that, both my son and my niece are in the first year of a residency program called physical medicine and rehabilitation. So they're graduated doctors, they're in residency, and I hope they come to work with me maybe at some point. That's, in my mind, that's one of the reasons we're building this new clinic is to have extra room for some good young doctors. Mm-hmm. I have had the distinct pleasure of training 25 doctors through a sport and exercise medicine fellowship program through the University of Manitoba, and walking with young doctors, again, developing really deep relationships with them. You know, my colleagues talk about who's your bromance with now, Neil? And I really do fall in love with these young men. They're fabulous young people, and you get to know them. I've got two this year. And that's a great legacy to have been able to teach and work with and mentor 25 physicians as they become sport and exercise medicine docs. I'm very, very excited about that.
Yeah.
I think this idea of the open hand, sharing what you've been given openly, that's very important to me. I've had a little legacy through my book, and I've had several people kind of come to a faith experience or see their life differently through reading some of the stories I relate to at my work at Silo Mission. And that's been very, very cool to see that type of change happen in people's lives. And again, I don't want to feel proud about that, but if you're talking about legacy, a guy who's in his 50s calling me, he's on the end of his second marriage and not really sure where he's going in life. And he's just read my book. And Neil, I'm not sure what I'm doing with my life. And that's kind of getting together, and I'm introducing him to a bigger group of people that have helped him kind of from a spiritual perspective, really change some of his, how he thinks and how he views the world, and about service and about chasing the brass ring. I think people are often so busy chasing success that they don't have success. And I want to practice at least 50 years. That's my goal. So I've got about 14 left, I think.
Well, that's good news for the rest of us that you're going to continue to do it for that time. And I was going to ask you about your book. What's your book called?
It's called Wisdom from the Homeless, Lessons a Doctor Learned at a Homeless Shelter.
Love that. When did your time at the homeless shelter begin? When and what, you know, what prompted you to do that?
I've been there for 15 years, and I heard about the clinic being developed, and I saw the woman who was running the clinic on television, and she was very passionate and talking about all the stuff she was going to do. And my time at Health Sciences Center had really helped me resonate with street people. I love dealing with them. I felt a nexus with them, and especially people from our Indigenous community. And I felt a real relationship there. And I knew that the population at Siloam would be very much like that, and really kind of went for a tour, did one shift. And my first or second shift, I saw things that really changed me from the inside out. And I had so many powerful experiences there and continue to have powerful experiences there that I wanted to write about them.
Yeah. Is there one you can share with us? Was there maybe one that said, this I have to write down into a book, that really spurred you on to put it together?
Yeah, there is one. And so I refer to my niece. Her name is Rachel. And Rachel is, again, in first year physical medicine and rehabilitation with my son, which is a crazy little nexus. There's two residents, and they're both, I know them both. So Rachel was thinking about going into medicine and wanted to come and spend some time with me at Siloam. So it's basically our first day together. And when you go there, you see stuff you can't imagine. Like you haven't got a clue. And so our first guy is blind. He's using a white cane, and he's got a very bad toe infection, and he can't really see his toe. And, you know, he wants us to look at his toe, and it's really quite nasty. It looks like a cherry ready to pop. And as we start speaking to him that we're going to have to do something for his toe, he says, well, I'm having trouble hearing you guys. I was beaten up on the street and my hearing aids were stolen. So he's a blind man. He's had his hearing aid stolen. He's the significant toe infection. And so we're dealing with him and trying to be as kind as we can and really taking, you know, extra time. And as we kind of finish our dealings with him, he says, when I'm there and Rachel's there, you know, you people have been so kind to me. I've never seen such kindness. And so at a chance encounter at a homeless mission, this guy sees kindness maybe for the first time in his life. That's his testimony. Well, we start making some phone calls, and within a matter of an hour, a very lovely group of people from a audiometric clinic on Portage Avenue have agreed to give him $3,000 worth of brand new hearing aids that very afternoon. When we tell him this, he starts weeping. Rachel starts weeping. I start weeping. And it's this kind of crazy, oh my goodness, how did this happen? Good news story. Never seen the guy again. This brief interlude. And that's what happens when you're at the homeless shelter. By definition, these people aren't your patient forever, right? They're in and out. But I've had many of those encounters where you go, wow, this something cool is happening. Now, it's not all, you know, joy there. And lately, I've seen lots and lots of trouble at the mission. The mental health crisis in our downtown area is deepening. It's being fueled by the substance use disorder crisis, mostly methamphetamine. And that crisis is deepening. And the effect of, on people's lives is logarithmic. And we're seeing lots and lots of seriously negative fallout as a consequence of that. Tremendous amounts of difficulty and sadness and disease and discord as a consequence of it. So it's an ongoing work. And you pull up your bootstraps and you go back and see what you can do the next week.
So I assume you're going to be doing that for quite a while as well.
Yeah, I hope to. I learn a lot there. There's a really good team there. Angelica is our team leader there. And man, they got a lot on their plate. And so, you know, the docs are just there like a half day a week kind of thing, where the real staff, the people doing the work every day, doing the hard work every day.
Yeah. Puts a lot of things in perspective, doesn't it?
You never feel sorry for yourself when you come home from Salom.
Well, you've put a lot of things in perspective for us. And thanks for letting us dive into your life and to sort of see what it's like from your side of things. I mean, we get to see the bombers on TV and watch the jets skate around. And we often don't know all the behind the scenes things and really the people that you're dealing with, not just the superstars or the names on the backs of jerseys. And I think that's really hit home and obviously has shown how, why you're inspired to do what you do. We want to get a little more perspective on you with some of what we're calling rapid fire questions. Just some different random questions that we think will, I don't know, will give us really some interesting feedback. So
you
ready?
You shoot.
Okay. You're 100 years old. What is the story you most love to tell?
I had a 12-year courtship with my wife and I was afraid of commitment because my family of origin was kind of messed up. Mm-hmm. And so that long journey, when I hear people breaking up with someone they love, hey man, this story's not over yet. So the story of our 12-year courtship and our, now we celebrate our first date. So we've been dating and married now for like 43 years and still in love. And so that's a story I love to tell.
Oh, great. Who or what do you think people see when they see you? And is there something different you wish they would see?
It's a really good question. Again, as part of my faith, I would love people to see Jesus when they see me, that they would see mercy, not judgment, that they would see compassion, that they would see a desire to help, that they would see kind of a wise teacher. That's what I would love for them to see. I think often they see kind of a proud, self-centered person. And that's not what I want, but that's my humanity. And, you know, the human doesn't want to get buried every day. It's very persistent. And so that's my concern, is that people see pride, they see affluence, you know, they see arrogance. And those are things I just don't want to communicate.
Do you think having just the doctor in front of your name sometimes puts you at a disadvantage in that light?
For sure. Absolutely. And we're talking a lot about power imbalances now in life and white privilege that I have, you know, growing up in affluence in Winnipeg and with all the things of, you know, being a cis white male, all those things, right? My eldest child has helped teach me lots of those lessons about life. And so learning those lessons keeps happening over and over again. And clearly when I introduce myself to patients, I say, hey, my name's Neil Creighton. And I would say, nice to meet you, Ms. Sawatsky. Like I try not to, hi, I'm doctor and you're Michelle.
Yes.
So try to change that power balance. And I think that that's where the waiter comes in very importantly. Is that it ultimately makes me submit. I get on one knee in front of the patient. That's my desire. There's something very cool that happens in the medical context. We close the door to the room and then you and I are locked together. It's a wonderful relationship. It's a sacred place where all we want now is you to get better and you trust me. And I ask you any question and you tell me the answer. And then that you let me touch your entire body to try to figure out the answer to this problem. And then we start brainstorming solutions. It's an incredible privilege to do that. And it's the art of being able to make you comfortable and the science to understand how we can really help but they work together, as we've talked about, to do that. And so, yeah, a distinct privilege that the word doctor in front of your name gives you, and you can make it power imbalance immediately, mm-hmm. or you can get on one knee and I think submit to the patient.
Oh, that's super cool. What is something people would be surprised to know about you?
Maybe the anxiety piece.
Yeah.
My wife would characterize me as an anxious person. I'm a hypochondriac. You know, we were on our honeymoon. I tell this story in the book. We went to Hawaii for our honeymoon. I looked down at my leg and I saw this red mark. And we've got skin cancer. This is it. Get out of the sun. And so I go in the hotel room and I start calling all the plastic surgeons. I got to get this thing off my leg. I got skin cancer. Well, we can't see you for 2 weeks. I got to get it off right now. So I'm sad and I'm mad. And then I think about, well, I'm going to get this thing taken off. They're going to take off my quadricep. I'll never run again. Wait a minute. I had a biopsy there when I was in med school as part of a science. That's just the scar from my biopsy. So we went back in the sun and had a good honeymoon. So I'm a distinct hypochondriac. And so that may be a surprise for people to think about.
What exhausts you?
Well, everything. I like to be exhausted. That's my goal. I like to physically work hard. So my idea of fun is like doing construction all day and then going for a heavy workout. So yeah, I like to feel exhausted. And I think that's ADHD in some ways. Okay. You've got to get rid of that energy. So I think that's an interesting thing. I like to feel, wow, I have worked hard. I am now tired. I get a little exhausted by the culture wars that I see around us, where we don't deal with each other with mercy. That exhausts me a little bit. Politics exhausts me.
Yes, many things. So then on the other side, what energizes you?
Well, I think that service energizes me. Teaching energizes me. And then I still love sport. There's a group who are involved in what we call it Otolo, which is the world's fastest growing sport. It's a swim run sport. And so we go to a lake and we do these swim run events. And again, my eldest child and I, we went on this 5-lake swim run thing where we run on a trail and swim in the lake and then run on a trail and swim in the lake. So we did that this year for about 2.5 hours. That energizes me. I just love doing that.
So cool. And finally, what was a moment of intense joy that you've experienced in your life?
Well, the first, I would say my book launch, that was a very, very cool day. That was at McNally. We had about 350 people there in a room that sits about 60 people.
Wow.
Telling that story to a lot of friends, it kind of felt like my funeral a bit early. It was a really cool day. And signing books, like that was the first time I'd ever signed books for people. Man, that was cool. So the stories in my book are they're metaphysical in nature. Being able to share that with people, try to inspire them to think about others, to think about the social determinants of health, to think about the need for reconciliation that I write about in my book. And so that was a very powerful day of joy.
Awesome.
That's the most recent one.
Yeah. 2 or 3 people who have influenced you in your life and how did they impact it?
So when I was a young fella, dating Kate, my wife, I attended her church and this optometrist, Dr. Burt Moore, kind of took me under his wing. And he was an elderly fellow, but was a tremendously important influence in my life. Helped me understand kind of the importance of being a person of integrity, studying scripture, living out a life of authenticity. He was a very important man in my life. And then I think my mom. My mom had a very, very tough life growing up in England, very, very poor. But she was a teacher and got her teaching degree in her 50s and taught until she was 70 and went to the Supreme Court, as a matter of fact, to establish the precedent that teachers do not have to retire at 65. And that became a Supreme Court precedent. And so my mom was a distinct inspiration to me. dealing with some of the difficulties in our family, with strength and with grace. So I would say my mom, very big influence.
Yeah. Awesome. Well, Neil, thank you. Thank you for sharing your heart with us, for letting us know of the early failures and the fainting spells amidst becoming Dr. Neil Creighton. You know, I think you've surprised us on a few fronts today. And yet maybe what doesn't seem surprising to me is I listen to you talk and I can hear it even in the tone of your voice, how much you really want to help others be well. And by being well, meaning the whole thing. And I think you're in such a great place to do that. And thanks for passing that on to your students and even to us for such a short time today. And yet we've gotten so much out of it. I'm thrilled. I've learned things. I've been surprised by things and I'm inspired. So thank you for your time.
I enjoyed speaking with you. You're very easy to talk to.
And that is Dr. Neil Creighton. And there you go. You have just gotten to know another hero in our midst. What a hero he is, hey? Neil, we have seen just what you hoped we would. The mercy, the compassion, and the desire to help. Thanks for teaching us that. Heroes in Our Midst is a podcast we hope you'll explore. You can find it anywhere you choose to listen to your favorite podcasts. And there are so many more inspiring stories just waiting to be heard. Thank you so much for listening to this one. And a big thank you again to Elite Sports Injury for making it possible. I'm Michelle Sawatsky-Coop. We'll talk to you again soon.